Good morning, everybody, and welcome to ITE Module 12, Part 2. We've had a fairly large module last week, so we decided to stop, and I think we were decided to stop because we got cut off the internet, seem to remember. So, nice to be back again. All right, last time we were talking about operating systems, different operating systems, and we got down to email settings and email applications. There's 100 million different email applications. Well, I slightly exaggerate, I guess. But what's everybody using, just out of interest, as their email client?
Good old Windows Mail.
Uh-huh. About everyone else? Everyone
else. Outlook and Outlook Distress.
I'm using Lookout Distress and Blunderbird.
Actually, I'm trialing one at the moment called Silfeed, which I just sort of was getting bored with my other ones. So, actually quite good too. Very easy interface. Had another look at one, but you had to pay for it. This was a free one. The other day, called the Bat. Has anyone used that one before? Pretty impressive, pretty powerful. Did you like it?
I think there are JavaScripts for the Bat, if I remember correctly.
It's actually quite impressive, actually. Quite powerful email tool. But yeah, this one called Silfeed was a free download, and I thought I'd try it and actually quite like it. Very simple interface, so there's not a lot of things in the way, particularly for JAWS users, and a lot of shortcuts that work, so I was quite impressed with it. Thunderbird I've always found pretty good. Are you liking it, Kerry?
No, actually.
No?
It's a bit clunky. There are certain things that don't talk properly.
Yes.
And it's not completely accessible. I mean, for an email client that is 100% accessible without any JAWS cursoring, you really can't go past Lookout Distress. Outlook is a little bit better, and often you're forced to use Outlook due to work calendaring restrictions. Anything else doesn't tend to be quite as accessible in my experience, unless anybody else has had better. There's also a bug you've got to fix with Thunderbird where you've got to stop it going X-Western, X-Western, X-Western. That is fixable, but you've basically got to mess around with a couple of configuration files to stop that from happening.
I would concur with Kerry.
Go on, somebody was asking something?
Yeah. Anyone use Becky?
I saw that. I haven't used it, though. Yeah, because, as I said, I was getting bored with my email clients. So. How did you find it?
Well, I haven't tried it with JAWS yet. I tried it with Windows and it worked okay. I've been kind of using the Mac lately, just to sort of play with it, you know.
The Mac. I'll tell you one really nasty thing about Mac Mail. Try getting down to the bottom if you've got 2,000 messages in your inbox. And no, N doesn't work.
No, it doesn't.
I haven't got that many.
Other than that, I quite like Mac Mail, actually. But, I sort of encourage anyone to have a go at try this Silfeed 2. Something or other it is. I've only been using it a couple of days, but it seems to be quite a nice, simple interface.
IMAP?
Yep, because I'm running IMAP.
Oh, good, Yeah, then I'm more willing to try them if they do IMAP, because I don't have to worry about where my mail goes.
Depends on how well they do IMAP, and it might be worth actually checking up with your IMAP server documentation as to whether there are hideous, horrible bugs in things, because often there are mail user agents that don't correctly implement the IMAP spec, and that can make a mess of your folders, so be warned.
Interesting.
Is everyone doing the server-side filtering or the local filtering for the folders?
Depends on what systems you've got available to you. I use DNS block lists on my mail server, and I'm looking at doing Spam Assassin. The problem with doing client-side filtering is you've already received the messages, so it's a waste of bandwidth, and in Australia that makes a difference.
Well, I just manually move everything, but it's quite tedious and annoying, so I think I'll set up folders.
I was talking about spam filtering, sorry. I didn't realise you were talking about dropping mail into
folders. Sorry, I was talking about Lisp, yeah.
There are message filters in Outlook Express that do work once they're set up properly.
One of the older email clients I used to like was Eudora, which I used for a long time.
That was great.
But yeah. Still quite usable, still downloadable and that. But yeah, I think, I mean, it's all individual choice, isn't it, as to what you like. But our email clients can be installed as part of our web browser or as standalone applications. And we've all spoken about Outlook, which is part of, or Outlook Express is an email tool component of the Windows operating system. So when you're actually setting up your email...
Outlook is actually part of Office. It is not part of Windows, and if you get Windows, you do not get Outlook. And I think it's actually part of Office Premium or Business or something. It's not part of the Office... oh, okay. Windows 7 doesn't come with a mail client. That'd be right.
Office came with 2003 too,
didn't
it? Outlook,
I mean. Outlook originally shipped with Office 95, if my memory
right.
I think it was Office 97, but you're right, 97 up to 2003, and I think Office 2007, but I would stand corrected on that one. But I'm using the 2003 one.
Yeah, I'm still using 2003.
I've just heard too many horror stories.
Sorry, what was that, Grace?
Yeah, your microphone's moved, I think.
Oh, has it? Okay.
There we go. That's
Grace has
better.
Had. Yeah,
oh, Grace,
better.
Sorry. I'm sitting moving
Grace
mine. Yeah, so when you're installing your email account or on your email client, obviously going to be looking at things, decisions with, you know, what name you're going to display. Inputting, going to need your email address, and you're going to need your incoming mail server name and also your outgoing mail server name. You'll also need a username and a password. And then you have to make the decision such as whether you're going to have a POP3 or an IMAP account. Anyone want to tell me what POP3 stands for?
Anybody know what the POP stands for?
I'll mention it. I was waiting for the students. POP, Post Office Protocol.
That's correct, and the 3 just means version 3. With POP3, it retrieves your email from the server over TCP/IP, and it actually doesn't leave a copy of the email on the server. But you can actually, with some of the implementations, allow you to specify that mail can be saved, and it gives you a period of time that you can save them for.
In fact, some ISPs have stopped people from doing this because basically you're using the ISP's disk server space, not yours. And in fact, some ISPs will actually smash messages after a specific time, so you leave them all on the server and 30 days later it'll wipe out your old ones that you didn't touch. And don't you just get cranky when you do it to them. It's great. And you try and point out to them that they've got 50 meg in their mail spool. And they go, oh, but that shouldn't be a problem, should it? And I said, yeah, 200 of you with 50 meg, that's a big problem.
Yeah, we've got a couple of clients who do it for us with our hosting, and I'm saying, well, if you want us to do that, you have to pay us more money.
Oh, yeah, that's fair.
Or you delete your messages, take your pick.
Gmail's good for, you know, keeping stuff.
Oh, there's some nasty things with Gmail. You can't send zips of exes because the Gmail traps them out, and it also looks at all your attachments and decides which ones it's going to let through and which ones it's not going to let through. And if you use Gmail as your outgoing mail relay, it will do you the courtesy of rewriting all of your from addresses so that everything looks as though it comes from your Gmail address.
Yeah, I've seen that, actually.
And it has this awesome setting that you can't change where it will make all of your replies from your groups not come back to you. So you have no idea unless you check the archives if your messages got through or not.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, it's ugly.
Okay, we also talked about IMAP, or mentioned it. Anyone tell me what that stands for?
Anyone apart from Elise know?
Elise?
Or does Elise even know?
I forgot.
Whoa!
So much for IT one last year, eh?
Oh, no. I'm sorry. We'll forgive you. It stands for Internet Message Access Protocol. Okay, and the difference with that is that... Yeah, you knew that, didn't you?
Yeah, it's only testing.
That's what I thought. And it allows your local email clients to retrieve email from the server, and typically it leaves a copy of the email on the server until such time as you move the email to your personal folders in your email application. So it also synchronizes your email folders between the server and the client. The other things we need to know about with regard to email is SMTP. Anyone want to have a go at telling me what that is? It stands for Simple Mail Transfer Protocol. And what that does is it transmits emails. That's it. Transmits emails across a TCP IP network. And it's an email format for text that uses ASCII encoding. It's ASCII, ASCII. Okay, another aspect we need to talk about is the multi-purpose Internet Mail Extensions, or MIME. And that extends the email format to include text in ASCII standard, as well as other formats such as in pictures and word processor documents and similar. And it's normally used in conjunction with SMTP. Some of the additional things that are available with email software is the automatic handling rules for emails, different types of email encoding such as HTML, plain text or rich text, and also for news groups. Anyone want to add anything on email before we move on or ask any questions?
I could add some stuff on email.
Yeah.
Anybody else want to go first, though?
No, I'll leave it up to you.
Okay. Some people use their ISP for their email storage solutions. Some people use systems such as Gmail for their email storage. Gmail is very good. However, you get what you pay for. So if if Google eats your email, you didn't pay them anything for it. In fact, if your ISP eats your email, you didn't pay anything for it. You must keep backups of your email folders. It is your responsibility to back up your email and your address book, nobody else's. So if you lose all of your inbox, I'm just going to be very sorry for you and I'll buy you a bunch of flowers, but I won't get you your messages back. A lot of people think that the email is magically stored on somebody else's file server and they can stop worrying about it. And in fact, a lot of people don't know how to back up their inbox or their email settings. Any of you who've been into C documents and settings, your username, application data, local settings, Microsoft, Outlook Express, big long hex number, Outlook Express, will have backed up your Outlook message store. If you're using like something else... Sorry?
Yeah, I think it's like identities / the hex number / the Outlook Express. The amount of times I've done it.
That's right, but it actually lives under local settings under Windows XP, but it actually lived in the root of the application data under Windows 98, I think, because they actually moved it under local settings in XP because it was a local setting. So it's worth knowing where your mail store keeps its files, and you can find out from the actual application itself. It will actually show you the store path if you go and look into tools, internet options, and that sort of thing. If you retrieve messages from more than one machine with POP, your messages will be fragmented across multiple machines. This is all good until it drives you absolutely stark raving mental and you find an iMac provider because you just checked your email on 3 netbooks, 2 PDAs, a mobile, and a partridge in a pear tree. And if anybody would like to tell us how to check email on a partridge in a pear tree, I'd like to know. But, yeah.
It's in your test.
Okay, some of us who have got far too much time on our hands or a little bit more technical expertise run our own mail servers, and in fact if some of us didn't run their own mail servers you guys wouldn't have any mailing lists, so woohoo. I use Exim and Dovecot. Dovecot is exceedingly fast, and it stores mail in MailDir folders. And despite what Craig says, MailDir is better than Mbox. And when his Mbox blows up and corrupts itself, I will be chuckling all the way to my MailDir.
I don't know what Craig's using. I'm using Dovecot myself.
Okay. Are you using PostFix or XM?
XM and Dovecot, and Dovecot handles the IMAP and the POP3 if I still want to pop off it. It's great, it's fast, as you said, it's excellent.
Yeah, I used to run Courier. Courier was a bit slower than Dovecot. There is also, the Mac tends to use a thing on the Mac servers called Cyrus IMAP, which sort of uses more databasey sort of things. But yeah, they're quite good, and we run our own mail servers, and we sort of fetch mail down to those either with get mail, fetch mail. There was another program that will actually fetch mail, I can't remember what it was called, but it does parallel connections and stuff.
Yeah, and further to that, there are now systems such as Zimba or whatever it's called that allow people to plug in and have Outlook calendars and all their emails for Outlook itself.
What the hell voice is that?
I think it's Microsoft
Anne. The one I'm running?
Yeah, is that Microsoft Anne or something?
No, it's Kate, but she sounds very scratchy on this.
I will slow your system down to a crawl as your CPU fan burns its way through the heatsink. But thank you for using Kate.
Anyway, I was saying about Zimba, I think it's called, and you can actually now get systems that allow you to share your Microsoft Outlook PSD file, which takes the calendar entries as well as the mail and the the addresses, etc. But it is exceedingly tricky to set up.
One of the things I found, though, with Zimbra was that actual functionality cost money. And I remember that all the other stuff worked, but if you actually wanted to be able
to... We'll sell it. We'll sell you I shouldn't be advertising on here, but we'll sell you an X amount of space for X amount of dollars. Yeah, we do it.
Anyway, so Zimbra will interoperate with Outlook to a degree, although I think the actual plugins to operate with Outlook did actually cost money to buy, so that's something to be aware of. There is a difference between fetch mail and get mail. Get mail is apparently better than fetch mail and doesn't tend to lose mail as often. So there you go.
You find people offering these services will often do what we do, and we'll sell X amount of space for X amount a month. So you pay, and I've got one or two clients doing it now. And they're happy, I'm happy, because I outsource it, and it's all cool.
I was actually talking about setting up Zimbra on your own equipment. I think you've actually got to pay some sort of license for the Outlook integration.
Yeah. Ares has had to set it up on his system. Oh, yeah, he's probably paid a fortune for it. I'm not going to do it. I'm sticking with all the Linux stuff.
Zimbra does run under Linux, but yeah, you do actually have to pay for that Outlook integration. That was my point. Okay, I think that was most of the things we wanted to say about email. Of course, there's a good talk on anti-spam if you go into the Thursday Chat Archives, and you can listen to all about how to get spam out of your mail so that you don't have to give it to her and make her happy tonight 10 times in your inbox every 2 minutes, because spam tends to come in waves. Do look at the anti-spam Thursday Chat if you are interested in filtering your inbox and keeping spam out of it.
And a few tips on how not to get your name on lists in the first place, if I remember rightly.
Yes.
Point.
lessen the risk of getting your name on spam lists. I don't think you'll ever stop it.
No, I think you're right there. Yeah, definitely. Okay. All right. Now, my notes tell me we've got to talk about screen resolutions. So once you've installed your operating system, you can play around with the screen resolutions to suit the needs of you or to suit the needs of your customer. When you're using an LCD screen, the resolution should be set to native mode or native resolution. And native mode is where the screen resolution it's actually set as the same number of pixels that the monitor has. So if you're moving it from, say, from native mode, you may not get the best picture for those.
Can anybody tell me why? Does anybody know why you don't get the best
picture? Because it's best to
match up
pixels with the actual number of pixels on the screen. With an LCD, with the CRT, it wasn't as big a deal.
Yes, and in fact the technical reason for that is with a CRT you have three electron guns, red, green and blue, which raster from left to right, top to bottom of the screen, and they can, depending on how you calibrate the electron guns, can do different pixel densities by shooting the phosphor with electrons, whereas with an LCD you have a specific number of pixels and that's it, and you can set that specific number of pixels to either be on or off, depending on the signals you're sending to your monitor, whether they're analog or DVI. And the reason why, if you don't set the same resolution as what your LCD screen is going to display, there is actually a little microprocessor in the LCD that interpolates between the native resolution and the set resolution, and depending on how good that interpolation chip is, it can make your screen look crummy.
Cool. So, word interpolation. I like that one. It is.
So for all of you people who can't see and you've got an LCD, don't drop the resolution to 800 by 600. It looks crummy. Just make your fonts bigger.
Well, now I know.
Yes, that's exactly what I do. I run the native resolution, which is nice and big, and I'll go into Windows and tell it to just bump the fonts a bit.
Anyone tell me where you set the resolution? Or how you would change it if you wanted to.
Display properties, control panel.
Yep, in control panel, that's right, yep. Okay, so screen resolution, when we're talking about that, it just determines the number of pixels. So the higher the number of pixels, the better resolution and clearer the picture. Alright, so what about the refresh rate? Anyone tell me how that's worked out? Well, how it's expressed,
that's
I should
how
say.
Many times it's in the rate per or how many times refreshes per second or something like that.
Yep, that's right, and it's also expressed as Elise said in hertz. That's right. So the higher your refresh rate, the more steady is your screen image.
Yes, less headaches you get. Can anybody tell me what the difference is between an interlaced and a non-interlaced monitor? Good luck finding a non-interlaced one these days, good luck finding an interlaced one these days, but anyone tell me what the difference between interlaced and non-interlaced is? I'll assume nobody knows. And this isn't as relevant as it once was, although it is still relevant, especially if you're dealing with TVs. An interlaced monitor is one that refreshes the even scan lines on one refresh cycle and the odd scan lines on the second refresh cycle. Therefore, you only actually get a refresh of the pixels on every second raster scan from top to bottom of the monitor, which is why non-interlaced monitors look clearer and sharper, because they refresh all of the scan lines rather than leaving the scan lines longer to fade on the phosphor.
Weren't the interlaced monitors the ones that made people sick?
No, any monitor with a lower refresh rate could make people sick. And just because a monitor is non-interlaced does not mean that it won't cause eye strain. And in fact, a lot of low vision people are badly affected by the refresh and the raster scans on CRT monitors, as they are also affected by the flickering of fluorescent lights, and especially if the capacitors in the fluorescent lights that do the regulating are becoming a bit iffy, or the gas is tiring, you can end up with lots of low vision people dashing to the bathroom with migraines. So watch the light flickers.
Okay, when you are looking at the display colours, the number of colours on the screen at once, well, if we think about the colours, they're formed by the intensity of the three basic colours, which is red, green and blue. So the more bits or the is the greater number of the colours. Now, there is something I seem to recall on this in your exam. When you have 256 colours, it's referred to as 8-bit colour. If you have 65,536 colours, it's referred to as 16-bit colour or high colour. 16 million colours is referred to as 24-bit colour or true colour. And 16 million colours is referred to 24-bit or true colour with 8-bit padding, and that's to allow for 32-bit processing.
And just a point. Yeah, that is in the test.
It is in your exam, I remember it.
And if anybody is in discovery, you should be able to work those out by going 2 to the power of the number of bits, and that will give you the number of colours. So 2 to the power of 16 is 65,536, all you binary people grin.
I was just sort of thinking of a song then, for some reason.
2 and 2 are 4. No, that one, or the other one.
Or ebony and binary. I think another word for ebony. Sorry, folks, it's Friday.
Everybody does binary, side by side on our pegboards. And that's enough of that.
Oh, dear. Definitely Friday, isn't it? Okay, so if you're having problems with your display, things that you would need to troubleshoot, anything which you might be thinking of, guys, problems with the LCD display, what would you be looking at first? Troubleshooting.
Video drivers?
Yep.
Whether you've installed a beta version of JAWS, just kidding.
Yes, yeah, so checking that the driver is compatible with your graphics card. Sorry, Scott, what was that?
I'm not going to comment about installing beta versions of JAWS.
Fair enough.
JAWS has done something that requires you to reboot your computer multiple times.
Even then, you may not be able to fix it.
Press enter and the system might reboot. Then again, it might not.
Don't talk to me about JAWS at the moment. I'm still mine's crashing.
You need .NET 2.0 installed.
Okay.
Because she's having that where the JAWS crashes all the time. Scott, you know the one where it goes, you know. Yeah. So anyway, the point I was going to make was yes. Video drivers. Also, you might actually need to get somebody sighted to look at your monitor, because often you won't be able to tell if there's a problem, and the sighted person might say there's a problem and you might not know about it, so that always helps too. It also helps to make sure it's plugged in too.
Yes, definitely.
You know, that can happen quite innocently, yeah. It can just come out.
That's all right. I was trying to work out why my printer wouldn't work yesterday. Guess what? It wasn't plugged in. Only took me a couple of minutes to work that out, so that wasn't too bad.
Yeah, my printer doesn't have an on, like it's got an on switch, but you can't hear it. You know, it's got one of those lights, and I'm sitting there.
Yes.
It doesn't work. I'm trying to print it and it was off, you know.
Yeah, how rude, eh? Oh dear. Okay, yeah, so where are you going to look for your current drivers?
Device manager.
On the crusty disk that came with your graphics card?
Oh,
that's what I was going to say. It's a sarcastic answer.
I'd say the.
Yeah, although be careful, because there is actually a nasty thing I came across, which bites rather badly, and just, yes, a correction, .NET 3.5 is the one you want, which should fix the JAWS issue, and I've got to remember where you actually go and get .NET 3.5 from.
Cool.
It's an automatic update if you want it.
Not on her machine, it didn't, and I don't know why.
No.
In fact, there's a bug in Windows Update that will block you from receiving certain updates if certain patches are installed and it's the third Tuesday on the second full moon.
I think there's a pane down the left-hand side of that screen when you use Internet Explorer to do your updates, and I think you can select another category of junk, of which...
But there's actually a bug.
One of them.
No, this isn't Vista. There is actually a bug where if you've got certain updates installed, it will actually block other updates from coming down in Windows Update. It is a known problem, and it wasn't in her default frame that I could see. So I'll go and have another look later. But yeah, it's actually missing, and we've got to figure out why.
Mm. Yep. Oh, it makes life interesting, though. It makes a nice little sound when it goes. It goes...
You install an earlier .NET and get it to update, because it might just find it by itself.
We tried that. Look, I personally haven't looked at it. I'll go through Windows Update after lecture and check it up. No, you don't want earlier versions of .NET on if you can help it, because that leaves a whole lot of cruft around your system that you don't really want. And in fact, 2.0 is the version that actually tickles the JAWS bug even more.
Yeah, sure. I've got a question I'll ask you after lecture about all that.
Sorry, Scott?
I've just found you something. I'm sending it to you in MSN. The direct download link for .NET 3.5.
Oh, aren't you a legend? Thank you.
That'll do.
Yeah, that'll do it. And we'll make sure Geraldine gets that in a moment.
Excellent. Thank you. There's a cyber lollipop coming your way, okay?
Yeah, you don't want to pay for the postage. I understand. <yeah.
laughs> That's right. Yeah, might end up a sticky mess in a postage. No, that's good. Okay, yes, so we are looking for, as Grace mentioned, looking for the correct drivers and having making sure that's installed, and looking for the manufacturer website usually to download that driver software. Okay. All right, now the notes are talking here about installation of a second operating system. So you can actually have multiple operating systems within one single computer. So when we have that, you can actually set them to dual boot. If you wanted to create a dual boot system in Windows, you typically need to have more than one hard drive, or the hard drive must contain more than one partition. You would install the oldest operating system on the primary partition or the hard drive marked as the active partition first. And you'd then install the second operating system on the second partition of the hard drive, and the boot files would be automatically installed in the active partition. During the installation, the boot any file is created on the active partition to allow the selection of the operating system to boot on startup.
And you need to know all this for your test, but of course if you're really doing operating systems, you've got a lot more tricks up your sleeve, and we don't follow Microsoft dogma. Get a real bootloader. So I just thought I'd add that in, because if you're trying to dual boot Vista and XP, it won't work unless you've actually got third-party tools to make it work, because Microsoft broke all their own rules.
Typical.
Sorry, continue, Geraldine. I was just pointing that out in case somebody...
No, that's okay. Yep. You can actually edit the boot ini file to change the order of the operating systems, and you can also edit the file for the length of time that the operating selection can be made during the boot phase. Typically though, the default time to select an operating system is 30 seconds, and the delay, there's always a delay in the boot time of the computer by 30 seconds. So unless you're actually changing that, it will be default to that. You can, in the boot any file, the boot time should be changed to 5 or 10 seconds if you want to boot up your computer faster. If you wanted to edit that boot any file, you could right-click My Computer, and then you go into Properties Advanced tab. And then in the startup and recovery area, there's a select settings, and then you would edit those settings. All right, your operating system needs to be upgraded periodically to remain compatible with the latest hardware and software, unless you really like what you're using. We all wanted to go to Vista, don't we? Oh, shut up.
You stress out for a XP license.
You like Vista, don't you, Grace?
I think we're getting no comment.
We got no comment, yeah. What version of Vista is she using?
She's got a business and a home one, I think she said last week.
Oh, okay. Yep. Okay. And as the new operating systems become available, we're coming up to Windows 7 shortly. You can choose to upgrade or continue to stay with your older versions, but you may not always have support for your older versions or easy support for your older versions. I think most of us are still using XP, aren't we?
Personally, I am.
Yeah, me too.
they tell me Windows 7 is a lot better, though.
It is.
Yeah, but they said that about all the other operating systems, too.
No, they're actually people who know what they're talking about are saying this at least, not just Microsoft.
Oh, okay, good.
Yeah, no,
it'll be interesting.
It's pretty far.
Yeah, apparently it's quite slimmed down. It's what Vista should have been, and it's actually had a whole pile of optimizations done to it. And to give you some idea, it even runs fast on the HP Mini Note, and that's saying something.
One thing I will say is that if you like the XP Start menu, like the classic Start menu,
yes,
it's gone.
Ah, no option to choose it.
Apparently you can hack around some registry tweaks and get it back, but I don't know.
I don't know. I mean, there are certainly advantages to both. I actually found the way that bits of the Vista Start menu appeared and disappeared and stuff was quite disconcerting until you got used to it. And I didn't realise that there was magically, if you magically pressed right arrow twice, you'd actually get to the shutdown options, which was probably quite straightforward if you were actually looking at the screen, but possibly not if you weren't used to Vista initially.
It's not if you look at the screen. Apparently, visually, I was trying to show someone where the shutdown option was, and they're like, where is it? I can't find it. So... Yeah.
I guess we all get used to the new menus over time. Kerry said, though, it can be a bit disconcerting when you first start up on a new operating system. But yeah, no, it'll be interesting to have a play with it. Okay, once we've installed operating systems, we need to automate some of the tasks, or we don't have to, but we can. That are for maintenance of our preventative maintenance. Some of the things that can be automated using the scheduled task utility, things like disk cleanup, backups, disk defragmentation, and you can actually open the scheduled task wizard, which is done through the Start All Programs Accessories System Tools and Scheduled Tasks, and then you can click to add your scheduled tasks. The Scheduled Tasks utility is a Windows-based GUI utility, and you can also use it as a command line or CLI utility as well, using a script file. And you can do that through your command prompt. Okay, the automatic updates. Most of us aren't probably using automatic settings, but you can use a number of settings to from automatic, which was where you automatically, obviously, having updates, Windows updates done, or download updates for me, and then let me choose when to install them. Or you can have an option where you notify me but don't automatically download or install them. And you can also have the turn off automatic updates.
Just a warning. And this is actually in the screen that shows you automatic updates. And I did mention this last time we went through this. If you actually have it set to anything apart from do not disable automatic updates, Windows will automatically... update portions of automatic update software behind your back, which is important if you're using mobile internet or something, because it might go out and fetch down a couple of hundred K without asking you, and that could be quite expensive. Also, they have threatened to actually put Windows Genuine Advantage on in future without actually asking you, and it could possibly go on. Whilst this will be a problem for nobody on this channel, it could certainly be a problem for other people with... shall we say, constructively licensed copies of software, they could get a nasty shock.
Yeah, I've seen the automatic update thing with the wasn't for me, but it was somebody who had a mobile internet thing and got a big bill for downloading, I think, a couple of 100 meg worth of updates.
You,
I think it downloaded Service Pack That's 3 nasty. Or something.
You've gone quiet there, Grace. Did you shove that microphone?
Yeah, I did. There, it's fixed.
Did your internet wobble or did your computer crash?
I had to switch.
Ah, fair enough.
I wrote that, but I guess nobody saw.
We probably did, but somebody was probably talking and that drowned out the...
Anyone tell me where you would find the options for automatic updates?
In the control panel under automatic.
That's correct, yep. Yep. Okay, something that's very saved my bacon a couple of times is restore points, which return your operating system to a, as they sound, to a predefined point in time. So sometimes you might have something that you've installed, perhaps a driver, and it's caused your problems with your stability of your computer, and you can actually do a restore point if you need to.
Or favourite screen reader,
oh,
right, yes.
Or favourite screen reader, yes.
Yeah, exactly. There is also, I think there was a thing that Grace was talking about called Deep Freeze or something that will also snapshot, save and restore your computer. Because I must emphasise this, and I don't know how many underlines and italics and big fonts I can put on this. System Restore does not protect user data. Ever, 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 ever. Keep that in mind. It does not protect user data, and it doesn't protect all system data either.
Yes, yeah, so what you've done in that time, you take it back, you've lost it.
But it only takes your system files back. It doesn't actually protect your My Documents or anything. So people think they can get
right,
stuff
yeah,
back in their
yeah.
My Documents, and it's not.
Grace, Deep Freeze, tell us about that.
They used it on our school computers at the ACC where I was in Colorado. And basically what happens is you freeze your computers. And it was great for a lab environment because you could do whatever you wanted to these computers. And when they shut down, they'd go right back to where they were in the beginning. There was a command to unfreeze it so that you could actually make real changes and they'd last. I don't know anything about that. I'd always be afraid to put that on my computer because I'd be afraid I'd make all these changes and it'd be frozen. And when I rebooted, you know, I'd forget and then have to do everything all over again.
Now, didn't I hear a story from a friend of ours, Elise, that apparently there was a utility you could run that would allow you to do absolutely anything you wanted till the system registry because until you rebooted. But I just can't remember what the utility was called.
I think I saw one. I think I found one made by the same people as making that registry defrag program that it seems to back up the registry. And I did actually put it back, and mostly everything came back the way it was. I know I dug up that program.
A bit like the errant and whatever the other one's called.
Yeah, it's made by the same mob who makes that registry optimizer thing we've been using. But of course, we won't go into the way I back up my systems.
No, he's got this cat, and he grabs it by the tail. No, he gets a copy of Linux, and he images up his entire hard drive, and he can then cat it back on, and then if anything remotely goes wrong or the screen changes a strange, opaque copy of yellow, he just cats the image back across the old system, and it's up and running straight away. And I've been gunning for NTFS clone, because it's much faster than catting, and it only backs up sectors that contain data. And you can find a copy on GRML, and it will go much, much faster. GRML 2008.11, and you can boot up with software speech, and you can cat images backwards and forwards, or you can NTFS clone images back and forwards, and it will be much faster than DD and cat, because it doesn't do every sector. Yeah, cat scan. That's right, Scott.
Cat scan, yeah. Okay, yeah, so talking about the system restore, how to do it, it's in the... start all programs accessories and then it's in your system tools and there is an option there for system restore. For example, in Windows XP you can actually create restore points. They can be are done in when you've got an upgrade, every 24 hours if your computer's running, or you can do them at any time. And as Kerry mentioned, beware, you might lose some of your data, but they can also get you out of trouble. Hey, all right, we talked, would you believe we're close to the end of this lecture, because we've only had a half one, so, all right, we're just going over briefly, we've been talking in the last couple of, this lecture and previous one about troubleshooting operating systems. Obviously, you're going to be remembering, because you're going to get it in your exams, about, you know, verifying issues, talking about with your customer, gathering data, finding out what happened at the time, using open-ended questions to identify problems as well. So get that in your brain, because it is in your test, I know. So we've been talking about installing different operating systems, and also troubleshooting those operating systems, ensuring that you know how to talk to your customers, and also preventative maintenance is sort of all we've covered in this last week and this week. So before we go on, I'll just give you a quick little quiz on this week's and last week's. We will be doing some changes over the next few weeks as far as the what modules we're actually undertaking, so I'll go through those just before we finish, as to which ones we're going to do. I think we'll only have another, actually, probably two, possibly three lectures for ITE1, so you will be missing out on two or three of the modules.
Now, can I just make a comment here? A lot of you are going to go, and then can we have some revision, and can you go over all of the really important stuff, and then can you go over all the really important stuff? May I suggest that people go back and read the chapter summaries? We will do our best to go over some of the important stuff, but the fact is we wouldn't actually bother giving you a 12 weeks worth of lectures if we thought we could just give you all of the important stuff in one lecture and then you'd be able to pass the test. The other thing that Jenny does, and if you have a Victor Reader stream, and sadly some of us don't have a Victor Reader stream anymore, and you certainly have my condolences, that would have been really awful. I'm not going to name who it was, but somebody knocked their Victor Reader stream into the sink the night before last.
Oh, no! Oh, no!
basically, that's usually a panic scrabble to rip the battery out and get it as dry as quickly as possible. In this case, that wasn't successful, especially that nasty dishwashing detergent would have got into the circuit board. That's really sad, and I'd be really cranky if I'd done it myself. But every time we say, that's going to be in the test, Jen presses the bookmark button on her Victor Reader stream and goes, new bookmark, bookmark created.
Good idea. Yeah, we do it to try and help. Yeah, so... all right, so if you can have your chat windows open, we'll just go through these. I've got half a dozen questions or so here. All right, so how many active partitions can a hard drive have? Is it A1, B2, C4, or D8?
Everybody's wrong.
Everybody's wrong, yeah. Yes, you can have one active partition.
Yeah, she said active partition, not primary.
I thought she meant partition. So.
I thought she just said partition.
No.
So did I.
I did say active partitions. Kerry heard me, didn't you, Kerry?
Yeah, and I've got three MSN windows and a couple of chat windows open, so yeah, she said it.
I did. Oh, well, never mind. Okay, which two file systems can be used by Windows XP? Is it A, DOS, B, EXT3, C, FAT32, D, HPFS, E, NTFS? Yeah, you're all right there, yes, C and E, FAT32 and NTFS.
There is actually a plugin that is third party that will allow you to read EXT3 under Windows. Actually it reads EXT2, it doesn't understand the journal, just so that people are aware that it exists.
Is that something that's used in Linux?
Yes.
It's one of the 10 file systems used in Linux, yes.
Okay, which system tool consolidates files to enable faster access? Is it A, file attributes, B, computer management, C, defragmentation, or D, disk format? And the winner is... Yeah, you're all right.
And as previously mentioned, you might want to have a look at Defragler, D-E-F-R-A-G-L-E-R, which is made by the same people that write CCleaner. And you may want to look at JK Defrag, just so that you remember the cool free defragmentation programs that you might want to use, especially if you're using Vista, because Vista's defrag, which is bytes.
Okay, how can the last known good configuration option be accessed? Is it A, you press the F8 key to access the advanced boot options, B, click Start, All Programs, System Tools Restore, or C, press the delete key to access the recovery console? And the winner was A, press the F8 key to access the advanced boot options. Okay. Next one. A new graphics card is installed in a computer. When the computer is powered on, the default drivers are loaded, but some of the applications don't work. What should you do to improve the graphics card performance? Should you A, check the Microsoft website to find the latest drivers? B, check the website of the manufacturer for the latest drivers? C, configure the application to run correctly with the new graphics card? Or D, configure the graphics card settings correctly in the start menu? She says, running out of breath. Yeah, you're all correct. Check the manufacturer website. Okay, what is the default Windows update setting? Is it A, automatically download recommended updates for my computer and install them? B, download updates for me, but let me choose when to install them? C, notify me, but don't automatically download or install them? Or D, turn off automatic update? You were all listening. Yay, good. Thank you. Yes, it was. The default was automatically download the updates and install. Okay, last question. Which Windows XP function allows a system to roll back to a previous state? Is it A, automatic update, B, NT backup, C, restore point, or D, scan reg? Oh, you all did well. You were listening to me today. Good. Yes, it was restore. Okay. All right. So next week, we are missing Chapter 13, not doing it. That's the advanced laptops and mobile devices. Then we're missing Chapter 14, which is advanced printers and scanners. And we're going on to Module 15. So Module 15 next week, which is advanced networks. And you can have an early mark today, because that only leaves us two modules to go, which is Module 15 and Module 16. Any questions, comments, whatever?
What was your question? No, don't skip the notes. You don't have to do the labs.
Test. Do have a read through them though, because it's good information.
Do the test. No, do the test. Yeah. Do the test. See how you go. We don't actually count it towards your final mark, so it'll be interesting to see how much you really know about printers. And no, people, just because you're blind, you can't be ignorant about printers. It doesn't work that way, because every sighted person has one. So we really do have to know about them, even if we find them the most boring thing that sits on the desk. Do have a shot at the test, and see how you go with it. If you bomb the test, it's okay. It's not going to pull your average down or whatever, because that's not the way the calculations work. Give the test a best shot, and you might actually find you will actually learn useful things in the advanced printers chapter.
And also the one on laptops and mobile devices. It's quite interesting things in there, but we're not actually assessing you on those two units.
So you just do the tests. You don't have to do the labs.
No, that's right.
I mean, if you want to do the labs, we'd be more than happy to get them, but you don't have to, which means that nobody will.
It's about right.
Can we take the 10 through 16 final as well?
You don't have to, but you can.
You can.
We think... Yeah, I think you can, because basically the advanced printers and advanced scanners just rehash the stuff that was in the original printer stuff, so there's not actually a lot more extra information in the actual chapter that, you know, you wouldn't have otherwise seen. I'm just curious, who are you with on internet, Chantel? Because you guys have got more unstable internet than the Indians. You can tell me off lecture if you want. Yeah, so if you want to do that 10 to 16 final, it's just a little bit more information than what was in the main chapters. It's not as scary as it sounds. Like, they have advanced written before them, but it really isn't that complex.
I was just curious if it was an option to do that, because I want to do it.
Yep, we can put those up for you.
Yeah, I think they're already up anyway, because I just did a select all, so, yeah.
The finals don't go up, but when you do a select all.
I thought you meant the module 13 and 14.
It doesn't count to the final mark. And the fact is, your final mark never appears on your certificate. Nobody will ever know what your final mark is except for you. Be aware of that. The certificate never ever says your final mark. So if you store 100% or if you store 80%, it doesn't really bother us, and it never shows up on your certificate. You either get the certificate or you don't. Obviously, we understand that people want to get as high mark as possible, but no, we don't think it impacts the final mark, because they are actually elective units.
By the way, Scott, downloading that 3.5 file, .NET 3.5, thank you very much.
Oh, yeah, that's fine. I was just on the phone, so I missed all that good stuff.
That's alright, the recording will go up soon. No, it doesn't affect whether you fail or pass. Yes, it does. In fact, we would deliberately go out of our way to make sure that there was stuff you couldn't do that would cause you to fail. That's the sort of people we are. Just a note for people who are listening to this lecture, I am being incredibly sarcastic. This course is meant to be completely unfair and undoable by people with a vision impairment, and we are going to be mean and awful and horrible and make you do modules that you cannot do. No, it will not disadvantage you. So if nobody has the idea by now, I'm sorry, we can't help you beyond that. Anybody else got any questions that we will answer seriously and calmly and peacefully before we finish up the lecture for today? I reckon we all go home early because it's really yucky outside.
Yeah,
it's what?
We don't have the good weather here.
It's wet and yucky outside. It's all rainy and windy over here.
Ah, still. I saw it on the news last night.
Oh, Geraldine's just got a phone call.
Blue sky, sunny and calm in Melbourne.
We don't want to talk to you then.
She's back.
I'm back.
No phones in lecture.
That was an important call.
Oh, they all say that.
So does anybody else have any questions, queries, problems, wibbles, issues? That they want to talk about before we shut the lecture down early. Everybody is 100% happy with their progress and happiness with the course at the moment. In fact, if we came up and surveyed you, you'd all go, oh, we're having a wonderful time. Anybody got anything they want to raise or talk about or anything that they would like clarified?
Yeah, please feel free.
And the notes are on www.qcat.org? No.
No.
We can put the final up whenever you want it up. However, we would strongly suggest... Is that like underlined enough?
That was strongly.
Strongly suggest that you do not attempt the final until you have completed all of the labs, because the labs give you information that will help you complete the final. So if you want the final up tomorrow, we can put the final up for you tomorrow. The final goes up for an 8-hour time window, and you get to attempt it in the 8-hour time window, and then you get two shots at the final. And the final does cover stuff from every module. Yes, Grace.
Can you guys put that up, like, before you... Can I pick a time window and can you guys put it up then? Or do you guys have to be awake to put it up when I want to do it?
No. Now, if you can let us know with a bit of advance notice, we can set it ahead of time.
Oh, good.
Is there a certain date it has to be done by? Like, you know, a certain date in the calendar we have to have all done the filing?
I think it's the 23rd of November or something, quite a long ways away, but don't put it off.
Okay, so it's the end of the year. Okay, go on. No, it won't take that long.
Yeah, but let me just give you a little hint here. If you sit back and don't do your labs, we're going to have a very cranky Geraldine if all of your labs turn up in September along with all the ITU2 labs. She will mark them.
Yeah, I prefer to get them as we go along, other than getting them all at the end, which has happened in the past and does not make for conducive marks from your marker.
Well, and you don't get a shot to redo them if you screw them up.
Well, that's right, yeah. And the other thing is, you know, you leave it all till the end. It really, really, not joking here, it is very hard for Kerry and I if we've got, you know, 100 students submitting all their labs right at the last minute.
Especially when you get calls going, have you marked my labs, sir? What are my lab marks, sir? Sir, what are my lab... I'm still wading through my inbox, people. Haven't even got to your labs yet. Okay, so any other things that people want to raise, talk about, anything like that? I think we've got everything mostly sorted out. We are looking at putting up exploration curriculum on the server if anybody is interested in taking a look. That's the advanced version of the discovery stuff. Yeah, we'll let you know when it goes up, and it'll have the same password, so you shouldn't have any trouble looking at it and getting in and doing it. Alrighty, I think we're done. I think
we are. Alright, we'll be hanging around on Skype, so you can get us there if you need us. And other than that, have a good weekend, everybody. And Kerry will be back with you on Wednesday. And I'll be back on Friday.